This segment of the Financial Sense News Hour is brought to you by Nationwide Financial. For more information about Nationwide's products and services, please visit nationwide.com. That's nationwide.com. Neither Nationwide nor any of its affiliates is related to or affiliated with Jim Poplava of Poplava Securities, Incorporated.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
One of the things you learn operating in broadcasting for long periods of times is to expect the unexpected. You always try to anticipate things that might go wrong. When things don't go wrong, you're pleasantly surprised. But if they do go wrong, then you're not surprised. And that's the core issue of any kind of planning is contingency planning. What about those things that you just didn't count on or things for which there's a probability that something might happen, but you don't know what that something is? Welcome to our Lifetime Income series here on the Financial Sense News Hour. We're beginning a two-parter today, of which today is obviously work real hard at this one, is part one. Planning for incapacity, disability, and long-term care. This is a complex subject. It encompasses a lot of points. So we are dividing it up into part one and part two this week and next week. So where do we make the thrust this week, Jim?
Well, let's start out. When you're dealing with incapacity planning, there's basically two concerns. One is the management of assets and property, and two is the decision-making for the individual's personal and medical care. What happens if somebody becomes incapacitated? Who makes the investment decisions? Who pays the bills? What happens if somebody becomes seriously ill, is in the hospital? Who makes those medical decisions? And John, this has gotten a lot more complex. And so when you deal with management of assets and property, and then also making health decisions for medical care, you need documents that allow somebody to do that. Now, the most easy one that most people use, it's called a power of attorney. A power of attorney is basically a written document executed by one person, let's say the individual, authorizing another person to act on his or her behalf. Now, the person granting the authority, let's say an individual that is retired, in legal terms, we call them the principal, and the person receiving the authority is called the attorney in fact. The problem with the power of attorney is the general power of attorney is not a very effective tool for incapacity planning for a simple reason. Is the person that has this power of attorney, that authority ceases when the client or individual either dies or becomes incapacitated. So let's say that you granted somebody a power of attorney, and all of a sudden your doctors are saying you have a stroke or you have dementia. You are deemed to be incapacitated. That power of attorney goes away and is ineffective. So that's why another document is called a durable power of attorney. A durable power of attorney is different in that it could be immediate or it begins when the individual becomes incapacitated. It doesn't lapse. It doesn't stop. And so that is a basic document that should be part of any individual's estate plan. Between a husband and wife, they should have durable powers of attorney, allowing the other spouse or somebody that they trust to have the ability to carry on their financial affairs rather than going through what is called a conservatorship. In a conservatorship, you get a court-appointed fiduciary who becomes responsible for managing the property and the financial affairs of either a minor or a mentally incapacitated person. And with an adult, the court requires a hearing to determine the competency. I mean, you really don't want to go through this. If something like this happens in your life, which is one of the reasons why you should have something like a durable power of attorney,
You know, as I'm listening to you say that, I was thinking about our trust that we created quite a number of years ago. And usually when you set up a trust, there is some provision for a power of attorney given certain circumstances. So what about some kind of living trust?
A living trust, whether it's revocable or irrevocable or revocable, is a much better way to plan for this. A husband and wife can set up their own living trust. They can be trustees of the trust, and the trust carries on the financial affairs. So in other words, if the husband becomes incapacitated, the wife would not have to be interrupted, go to a court, be appointed as a conservator. She would be able to carry on the financial affairs, make the decisions. It is a much more flexible document. It also keeps financial affairs private versus a conservatorship. It does not require court appearances or accounting to the court as conservatorship. And furthermore, the trust authority and transactions are routinely accepted by financial institutions, sometimes with powers of attorney or durable powers of attorney. You may find some financial institutions are reluctant to accept that power of attorney, where living trust are easily acceptable at most financial institutions, John. So these are key documents that you need to have to carry on the financial affairs, the management of your investments, you know, the accounting, the property, all those kind of things are much easily taken care of with a living trust, especially between a husband and wife, and especially, John, when it comes to managing the investments, the business affairs in a marriage. You just don't want to go through a conservatorship. And even if you're a single spouse, let's say that you were married, you lost the spouse, whether, let's say, the wife that's the survivor or the husband, when they have a living trust, they can also have a co-trustee or successor trustee appointed that can carry on these financial affairs. So that's, you know, one of the first documents that you need is either a durable power of attorney. You know, for some reason, you don't see trust used a lot in the Midwest. I've come across a lot of cases because we have clients around the country that don't have the proper trust documents as we do, let's say, here in California.
I want to look also at not just financial affairs, but medical affairs are going to be a big issue, especially in case of incapacity, where other members of the family, ostensibly a spouse, have to make decisions for the other partner. Making medical decisions is an important issue. Some people even say, you know, if you know you live in a particular area, you should say, for example, when you get these documents made up, of which we are going to speak, that you should file them with your local hospital so they already have them on file.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of things that you need. Just as we talked about managing one's financial affairs, if you become incapacitated, another one is managing medical issues. Now, there are a number of documents out there. One is called a living will, which is a revocable document that basically allows a person to state in advance what life-sustaining medical measures related to, let's say, hydration, respiration, nutrition should be taken by a healthcare provider if the maker of the living will is incapable of consenting to treatment. Generally, living wills have to be written, they're signed and witnessed by persons who are not heirs or beneficiaries of the maker, because there could be a conflict of interest. Yeah, pull the plug. I'm one of the beneficiaries. So it's one of the documents used. However, it has some limitations, and just as there are durable powers of attorney, there are durable medical powers. It's a revocable written document where the principal, the individual, authorizes a named person in advance to make healthcare decisions on their behalf in the event that either he or she is incapacitated. The medical proxy is known as what we call advanced medical directive. And it allows this individual, not the attending physicians, to make the healthcare decisions. So this is another document that would be in case. And by the way, usually what happens is two physicians must conclude that an individual is incapacitated. And then the authority granted by the durable power of attorney is given, but it does not survive the principal's death. But, you know, these are two basic documents that you're going to need to handle the issues of incapacity, disability, or even long-term care. Living trust, in my opinion, is a better way to handle financial affairs than, let's say, a durable power of attorney. And then also a durable medical power is a document that you need to add to your estate plan to make those medical decisions, because we know the longer that we live, and we are living longer today than we were, there are much greater chances for individuals living into their 80s, and a 25% chance of individuals 65 today could live into their 90s, because we've seen all kinds of things that have happened over the years. We've seen better medical care. We know a lot more about nutrition today. A lot of retirees today are taking better care of themselves through exercise. So as a result, people are spending a larger portion of their retirement years or adult life in retirement. So as we age and get older, these issues of incapacity and disability and long-term care are going to become more pronounced, especially the older we get. If you take an average life retirement span of, let's say, 20 to 25 years, chances are you start getting into year 10, 15, or 20, you're going to be facing these very issues. And one of the key things that you want to have is make sure that you've got the documents there, that your financial affairs are going to be able to be handled without going through the court and getting the court to appoint somebody you don't even know as a conservator to oversee your financial affairs. And more importantly, when it comes to medical issues, somebody that you trust and have a high degree of confidence can make those important medical decisions should you become incapacitated.
Planning for Medicare is really very, very important. And right now, as people who are getting ready to retire do so, there is a lot up in the air, especially because of Obamacare. And what is really uncertain to people is how much are they going to be under Obamacare? How much are they going to be under Medicare? What's being gutted to pay for what? And what will they not be eligible for?
Yeah, I think it's very important that we just start with the basics of Medicare, John, where an individual becomes eligible for Medicare at age 65. Now, if you are working, currently working with an employer that provides a medical plan, you can forgo applying for Medicare and you will not be penalized as long as you are working for a company that provides a qualified medical plan. You don't have to apply. But let's assume that you're retired or nearing retirement, you plan to retire, you're age 65, there are various aspects to Medicare. There's Part A, which basically helps to pay for hospital expenses. Now, Part A coverage is provided to most people without a premium payment. As long as the individual or the spouse has put in the required amount of pay-in period, which is 40 quarters, which is equivalent to 10 years, there is no premium for Part A coverage for those who have contributed to the Medicare system for 40 quarters. The monthly premium for others may be less if you haven't fully paid in. Now, Part A coverage, as indicated, is normally free. There are deductibles and co-payments for the services received. We don't have time to go into all of the details, and I'm going to give you a website that you can go to. In 2012, the cost of a hospital stay are as follows. From days 1 to 60, there's a $1,156 deductible for up to 60 days. From day 61 to days 90, there is a $289 per day copayment. From days 91 to 150, there's a $578 per day component. So you can see, if you have a serious illness, even with Medicare, there are some serious expenses here. And after day 150, the patient is required to pay all of those costs. Now, I want to go to Part B. Now, Part B covers physicians and outpatient expenses. The monthly premiums for Part B range from $99.90 to $319.70, depending on your income. And this started to phase in 2010. Individuals with incomes less than $85,000, if you're single, to $170,000, pay $99.90. Annual income above $214,000, the premium increases to $319.70. So, and then there's a period in between there where they gradually phase in some of those payments. Now, Part B also requires a payment of an annual deductible. The annual deductible for Part B of your Medicare is $140 in 2012. And you can go to Medicare. Let me just repeat this, because if you want to get more information about this, you can go directly. There's a PDF that you can download, and you can read it yourself. Now, here's the website. It's www.medicare.gov/publications/pubs, that's capital P-U-B-S, /PDF/150. That's 100, that's 1050 dot PDF. It lists all the benefits that are covered, and it talks about the co-payments that you would be responsible for. So this is very important. And as I said, there's up to 90 days, up to 60 days, up to 150 days. It talks about home care, outpatient care. If we take a look at it, the first 60 days, to sum it up, Medicare pays everything except for the first $1,156 deductible. After that, they pay everything during that 60-day period if you're hospitalized. Days 61 to 90, you're responsible for paying $280 a day. From days 91 to 150, you pay $578 a day. And if you're in a hospital more than 150 days, you're responsible for 100%. And then also, if you're in the hospital, Medicare pays for the first 3 pints of blood if you need a blood transfusion for, let's say, heart surgery or something like that. After that, then you have to pay the difference. There's also post-hospital skilled nursing care. The first 20 days, the patient pays nothing. Days 21 to 100, you pay $144.50. Beyond 100 days, you pay 100%.
Jim, as you're saying that, I'm thinking about supplemental insurance, because there's X amount that Medicare will pay, and then supplemental, I know in my mother's case, picked up virtually everything else. So what about supplemental insurance?
I'd like to get that first, but we're still not done with Medicare. There's parts A, B, C, and D. Part D was the one that was put in by President Bush. That's prescription drug coverage. If you opt for Part D, the individual pays a $320 deductible. Then, anything over $320, the next $2,610 is split, with 25% of that amount paid by the individual, which is $652.50, and then Medicare pays the other $1,957.50. So if you take a look at the $320 deductible, and then the 25% of your portion of the first $2,600 after that, you're on the hook for about $972. Now, after that amount, then it's called the donut hole. The individual will be required to pay 100% of the cost, spending an additional $3,727, all the way up to you're spending $6,657.50. So after the $2,610, you pay the next 100% of the next $3,727.50. After that, once your cost now exceeds $6,657, and now you might think some of these drugs, John, can get quite expensive, especially depending on the illness, Medicare then takes over after that amount, paying 95% of the cost with 5%. So that donut hole is that amount of money between $2,610 and $6,657.50, where you're on the hook for 100%. So, although you can get some discounts.
Well, can a lot of that be covered by what people call Medigap, meaning supplemental type of things? I mean, theoretically, you could, if you did the right types of insurance, you could box yourself in fairly well so that what Medicare doesn't pay for, the other does, and then the dust settles out in the end.
Yeah, you can buy Medigap insurance, John, and there are different plans that go with the alphabet. There's plan A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L. And we just added in the last 2 years Medigap plans M and N. So there are a whole list. And when it gets to Medigap insurance, there's a couple things to understand. First, you cannot be turned down for Medigap policy as long as you apply for it within 6 months of enrolling into Medicare after age 65. Furthermore, the law states that pre-existing conditions, when applicable, can be excluded for only up to 6 months. So there's a whole list of each state has different Medigap insurance policies, and it's very difficult to do a whole show on this. But the most important thing is if you are eligible for Medicare and you need to apply for it and you need to apply for your Medigap insurance within 6 months, you have a 6 month time frame to do that. And the reason that's important, John, is if you don't apply for it, then the government starts adding a penalty. And that penalty never goes away. In other words, your Part B Medicare premiums will be higher. They'll never go back down. And the same thing with your Medigap insurance. And unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time to get into a lot of this, because what I wanted to do is next week we're going to cover the Medicare Advantage program, where it's available, and talk about it, because a lot of individuals are opting for the Medicare Advantage program versus Medicare C, and there's a lot of controversy over Obamacare, where they may be cutting funding or some money is cutting out for Medicare Advantage. And so that's something that I want to cover next week on the program, where we also talk about long-term care insurance. Is it appropriate? What should you look for? What are keys in the policy? And I also want to talk about something that you don't hear talked about very often, which is disability insurance. Because when you look at disability, you know, most people that are young, they think, boy, I'm healthy. Most people, if they get married, they'll probably have life insurance to cover the family, take care of the spouse, pay off the mortgage, take care of the kids. If they become, you know, if something happens, they die prematurely of an illness, or they have something like, they get in a car accident or something. But, you know, here's the interesting thing. Disability insurance is insurance that covers up to 75 to 80% of your income should you become disabled as a result of an accident, an illness, or something that no longer allows you to work. And here's an interesting statistic, John. A 25-year-old American has a 45% chance of experiencing at least one period of disability lasting 3 months or more in his or her lifetime. A 30-year-old individual has a 2.5 times chance of experiencing a disability than death, 2 times more likely for disability of a 40-year-old than death, and 1.5 times more likely for a 50-year-old. And this is something that nobody really talks about. Now, some employers do provide disability income benefits. So, you know, John, we've got a little bit of time. I'd like to cover disability income because it's overlooked in most planning and will save Medicare disadvantage in long-term care and also Medicare penalties in terms of applying for Medicare when it applies. We'll probably continue that next week. But I did want to cover disability, because what disability is, it's loss of income. And, you know, you can talk about, for example, when we talk about insurance, You can buy insurance for property which is lost or stolen. That can be replaced. So you can even buy insurance for, let's say, home. Let's say your home burns down. It's damaged from an earthquake. You can buy automobile insurance if it's destroyed. So people usually do that, John. We have most, if you have a mortgage on your home, your lender is going to require you to have some kind of home mortgage insurance to protect the house against fire or something. If you have a car, you're required to have automobile insurance, or if property is lost and stolen. But John, here's the key. All those things, owning a home, having an automobile, all of that is dependent on that you have an income stream. In other words, you have a job. Those things are supported by earning power. And a lot of individuals mistakenly believe, well, you know, if I get disabled, I'm covered by Social Security. The problem is, if you take a look at Social Security's definition of disability, it is any occupation under to get disability from Social Security. If you could work on a street corner selling apples, you're not considered disabled. And so there's a big myth. Oh, I don't have to worry about that. Social Security will cover it. They do cover disability, but try going through the labyrinth of trying to get qualified for disability income from Social Security. Good luck with that. You'll probably end up hiring an attorney. But what I'm talking about here is a disability policy that either your company provides, either it's a short-term policy, or it's a long-term policy, and short-term policies are usually 2 years or under. They usually kick in from day one up to maybe a waiting period of day seven. These are most applicable, John, like for car accidents or something like that, where you might be disabled, not be able to go to work. You're going through rehab, and these are what we call short-term disability policies. And then we have long-term disability policies, depending on your occupation, that can cover you for 5 years. Usually if you're a blue-collar worker, it's going to be hard to get disability insurance that covers you for more than 5 to 10 years, because blue-collar workers are generally in higher risk occupations like construction, you know, falling off a roof, getting injured. So, but for Social Security, even if you can qualify for it, it's like anything else. You must have at least contributed to at least 5 of the previous 10 years, in other words, 20 out of 40 quarters, to qualify for this. And the other thing is, when we take a look at these policies, and also, by the way, your spouse, if you were to be eligible for Social Security disability, your spouse, if you passed away, would be subject or could qualify for 50% of the benefit, which would be reduced by if your spouse was under the full retirement age. But they're unlike regular medical policies, underwriting policies for disability are much more strict, much more thorough than qualifying, for example, a life insurance policy. And secondly, you're not going to be able to cover all your income because there's too much of an incentive. And the real key thing when you're shopping around for disability policies is the definition of disability, because that is strict. The more stricter the definition, the harder it is to collect, and that certainly applies with disability coming from Social Security. There is what we call own oc or own occupation, which, for example, a doctor that's a surgeon. Let's say he has a hand injury, breaks his wrist, or something happens, carpal tunnel syndrome. He can practice medicine, but he can't practice surgery. He could collect on disability. So the key things that you look for in a disability policy are three things. You look for the definition of disability, the waiting period, which is how long you have to wait before you collect, and then also the benefit period, how long this disability will pay. Most policies, long-term policies, especially if you're not blue-collar, they will cover you to age 65. After age 65, your disability turns into sort of like a Social Security. And then also the renewability, whether it's partial or residual renewal, because you want to have the ability to, as you get older, just like life insurance, everything else becomes more expensive. Your risk for some kind of disability also grows. And so those are probably some of the key provisions that you want. Now, if your employer pays for it and you receive it, it is taxable income. If you pay for it and receive it, it's tax-free. So there's a lot of tax implications. If you don't pay anything, you know, if your employer gives you a disability policy, as some do, and you become disabled and start receiving, you're going to pay taxes on the income. On the other hand, if you go out and buy your own private policy, let's say you're self-employed and you buy a disability policy, you make the premiums, they're tax-free when you receive them, because it's just like life insurance. The death benefits are paid tax-free of any federal income taxes. So, John, I wanted to just briefly cover that because it's an area that's overlooked in planning. And you don't think about this, but I think back of, gosh, in my own case, in 1994, I had a severe case of pneumonia. I didn't even realize I had pneumonia. I thought I was a flu. And, John, I ended up in a hospital and flat on my back for well over a month. It took me about 3 months to fully recover. So those statistics that I gave you, the odds of, let's say, an individual 25 being disabled are 40%, 2.5 times for an individual age 30, and one and a half times an individual age 50. It's often overlooked in planning. So that's all the time that we have to cover today, because I also want to talk about another kind of planning, which is planning for the unexpected, which we're going to cover in the next segment of Lifetime Income.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
I do not love for silver. I do not love for gold. My heart is mine to give away. It never will be sold. So baby, the rain must fall. Baby, the wind must blow. Wherever my heart leads me, baby, I must go.
Joining me on the program next is Kevin Matsukata. He's Administrative Safety Officer for Scripps La Jolla. And Kevin, you and I did a presentation for congregation members of a couple churches a couple weeks ago, and you did a presentation on emergency preparedness. And before we get into that, which I'm going to ask you to share with our listeners, could you give our listeners a little bit of your background, what it is that you do?
Okay, a little bit of my background is, back in 1980, I was the former State of Hawaii Disaster Preparedness Coordinator in the hospitals. So my main objective was to make sure that all these hospitals were prepared for any type of disasters. As you know, in the state of Hawaii, we come across hurricanes. We get prepared for tsunamis. So I would make sure that our hospitals were equipped with the emergency generators, make sure they get the water supplies to the hospitals, and then make sure that the patients are taken care of. So that was my main objective in the state of Hawaii. Then in the year 2004, I was recruited here to San Diego to work at one of the hospitals here. Yeah, I was at Palomar Palmetto Health, and I was also the disaster coordinator and director of safety and security. And I would pretty much do the same thing to make sure that the hospitals are prepared for any type of disasters. The disasters here in San Diego was a little different from the state of Hawaii. We had to prepare for wildfires. We had to prepare for earthquakes. And we had some power outage problems here in San Diego. So we started making sure that we had the right type of equipment to make sure that our emergency generators were working, that we had a good supply of water, mainly those two components to make sure that our staff and our patients and any visitors in our healthcare field was secured. Then recently in 2008, I moved over to Scripps Memorial Hospital in La Jolla, and my function is as Administration Safety Officer, and I play an important role in preparing for emergency preparedness as well. And recently what we do is that we come up with a hazardous vulnerability analysis checklist, and we notice that the disasters are still the same here in San Diego, which is number one, wildfires, earthquake, and power outage losses. So that's pretty much it in a nutshell of how my job scope is to prepare individuals in the healthcare field.
Now, when you gave your presentation a couple of weeks ago, I wonder if you can share that with our listeners. Obviously, they can't see your slides, but you talked about some very simple, practical things you need to do. Because, Kevin, even here in San Diego, I can remember watching the news for, I've lived here for three decades, and, you know, the earthquakes, was that something that happened in Los Angeles, maybe San Francisco? The hurricanes are on the Gulf Coast and the East Coast, along with the tornadoes. Although San Diego did have a tsunami in 1966, this is something that happened elsewhere. But we had a fire in 2004, and in 2007, we had to evacuate over 500,000 people in this city. And then recently, last year, the lights went out in September for almost 8 or 9 hour periods. So it's something that is beginning to touch more and more of our modern society. Can you, if you could, share some basic things that all of our listeners should keep in mind that will enable them to prepare for any kind of disaster, no matter what it is?
Right. Here in the healthcare, we have a large scale of preparedness regarding disaster supplies. But let's take it to the residential environment, where they also can get prepared for disaster supplies, and it doesn't even have to really cost them a big budget to get some of these items to prepare. For example, if you get an earthquake, a lot of times the earthquake would affect the power, would affect water. So what the family should be preparing for is like a disaster kit. And you can start small. You can get a cooler because it's watertight and it doesn't get affected by the weather. And you can have simple supplies like a radio, transistor radio with a battery. You always want flashlights and extra batteries just in case, you know, the disaster goes long for a longer period of time. Another small kit you can get is a first aid kit that will help in any type of injuries that maybe a family member might suffer through. Medication is also important to make sure you have a good supply of that. Make sure you have a handful of cash, because when the power goes down, as you noticed in history here in San Diego or in California, the gas stations, the supermarkets, their power goes down as well, so they don't have those cash registers working. They'll probably just collect cash. Another one that would be important is you want to supply your family with water. So maybe you try to want to prepare for at least 72 hours for it. Here in the hospitals, we prepare for 96 hours. For realistically, for homes that are just getting started, would be a good 72 hours. Along with that, make sure you got to have some extra clothes, blankets, and some special hygiene things, sanitation supplies, also that you may have to evacuate your home. And these items will definitely assist you when you start moving to another safer area. Another one we want to focus on is family communication. With the family communication portion is that the families will not be together when a disaster strikes sometimes. So you want to make sure that you account for each family member. And how you do that is, here's an aha moment where when there's an emergency, everyone tries to connect each other on their cell phone. But we discovered that when you try to do that, a lot of the lines get all tied up and you're unable to contact someone in the state. So a good recommendation would be if you can contact someone out of the state, like another family member or a friend, and when a disaster strikes, have your family members, if you're not with them, to contact that friend or family member, and they can give an account that you're safe and you can get an update of your condition and some of the areas that you might be concerned of. So that'd be taken care of by dining out of state versus trying to contact each other within the state. Another thing that you want to have is you want to have important documents. You can get a fireproof safe, and those you can buy at your local markets where you want to keep your important documentation, because sometimes you don't have enough time to go ahead and grab those pertinent documentation. So you can go ahead and leave that in your house and it's on a lock safe. Then when the disaster settles down, you can always go back and go get something. If you're in an area where the roads are, you can't transport anything and the roads for transportation are down and the county or the state is telling you to stay in your area, well, you don't have power, you don't have water. So what you can do is you can get an emergency generator. These portable generators can last for hours and it can last for a day or so. And it just depends how big your generator is. And they're not that costly. They can cost from $200 all the way to $1,000. Another thing that you can have, if you're an expert camper, Those are the type of equipment that you want to make sure that you have around the house. Propane grill, you can use that. You don't have to use any electricity, but a lot of families already have those propane grills all set for you, for your families to feed your family. And if you have enough supplies, you can even help out your neighbors. That is very helpful in the event of a disaster. Another key issue would be making sure your vehicle is half full with your gasoline. A lot of times, if you can get into the practice of doing that, because when you have to evacuate the area and use your car, you have enough gas to get you to a safer place. So that would be a great practice to make sure that your vehicle gas level is at least half a tank full. And sometimes you want to focus on your animals. Caring for your animals is very important. Make sure you carry at least 2 weeks of supply for food, for water, for your animals. And you want to take your veterinary records with you to the animal shelters just in case your animal can't travel with you. Red Cross has a setup where you can go ahead and take your animals and they'll take care of your animals for you. Another bonus would be if some of your family members and your neighborhood friends have been certified in CPR, have certified in first aid. So in the event a family member gets injured, these individuals can help out with the safety skills that they have regarding resuscitation. Also, there's technology where you can get an automatic electronic defibrillator that's located in the general malls that you can use in the event someone suffers from a heart attack. And finally, I'd like to just say that there's so many resources out there that you can go ahead and take a look at. One of the common websites is ready.gov. It's www.ready.gov. And basically, it gives you all the tools. It gives you plans on how to prepare for emergency preparedness and evacuations with your family. Another website would be FEMA, www.fema.gov. That also gives you a checklist of what to use for a disaster supply kit, what essentials that are needed during the disaster. And one of the websites that are used commonly is the American Red Cross at www.redcross.org. And it pretty much goes over everything that I explained within, you know, the couple of minutes regarding how to prepare for a disaster preparedness.
Well, Kevin, listen, I want to thank you for joining us on the program, because this is stuff that you have to deal with on a real-time basis, because anytime we have an emergency, whether it's an attack like 9/11 or it's a weather-related disaster, whether it's a hurricane, whether it's tornadoes, tsunamis, mudslides, rainstorms, power outages, you know, the first line of response are you guys, because if people do get injured as a result of these accidents, you know, we need our hospitals to function. I appreciate you coming on the program and sharing that wisdom with our listeners.
Hi, thank you, Jim.
You know, in listening to Kevin, Jim, one of the things that I think is really critical for people to have is checklists. Checklists are what pilots use. They're used elsewhere because in an emergency, you don't tend to think. In other words, you tend to, the fine motor skills, fine thinking tends to go away depending on how grievous the emergency is. And the tendency to run around like a chicken with your head cut off becomes really prevalent. I've been through a couple of major emergencies with my family that way, and that's exactly what happens. But when you have a checklist, you grab a piece of paper that's there and it has everything written on it. And you can get some of these from places, like you said, from FEMA. Some people have put books together. There's a book out called When All Plans Fail. It's by a medical missionary, ironically, Dr. Paul Williams, who sees the same problems we're seeing, and you can get that type of thing. And it's just loaded with checklists. You know, what do you need for your first aid kit? What do you need for this? If you're going to have to run, what has to go out the door with you right now? Okay, grab this, grab that, grab this, grab this. We got everything. How do we know that? Because we did the checklist ahead of time. See what I'm saying? So checklists are really important. Second thing that is really, really critical, and I have seen people run out of gas in the middle of California wildfires. And when my kids learn how to drive, we live out in the country, and I said, there is no excuse for running out of gas. When your indicator gets to half, go somewhere and fill up. It costs as much to fill it from half to full as it does from where it's not running to half. You know, so there is no excuse. I saw that happen during the wildfires back in 1980. A friend of mine, flat out of gas. No excuse for that. And so these are all the things you need to think about. But the real important thing to realize is that in an emergency, you aren't going to be thinking. in many cases. And so you have to go through checklists. You know, in martial arts, they call them doing muscle memory. So the response is just there. This is pretty much the same thing. Same thing for pilots. If you remember when Sully put the airplane, the Airbus 320 in the Hudson River, remember that? If you listen to the cockpit chatter, you can hear him going through the checklist. You know, remember this, remember that, remember this, remember that, do this, do that. You know, they're going through what they rehearsed a dozen times before, and everything that has to happen happens.
Well, you know, this is something that really struck me, John, and this started very early with us, because in the latter part of the 90s, because of a lot of the wacky environmental policies that we have in California, where we haven't expanded the grid, we're not building new power plants. In fact, we're trying to decommission the ones we have. And we began to go through rolling blackouts. And they're happening more frequently, and especially like we just got over, hopefully it's over, an extended warm spell that has lasted since the first week of August. And so when you go through these rolling blackouts, and it happened several times, I can still remember to this day, John, it was, I believe it was the year 2000. Greenspan was raising interest rates, and there was a Fed meeting. And we had a rolling blackout. We were informed that power would be shut off to our building for a four-hour period. And I can remember going outside in my car, turning on my radio to find out what the Fed did. The Fed raised interest rates. And I said, you know, we've got to have a backup plan. And so we began a series of backup plans. We have Plan B, Plan C, and now we have Plan D as a result of the institutional fires that we experienced in this city in 2007. But for the longest time, for at least living here, at least the first probably 20 years that I lived in California, disasters were always something that happened somewhere else. It happened, you know, in another state, another part of the country, or another part of the world. Because if you take a look at all the weather-related events we've seen, whether it was the Fukushima earthquake and tsunami, last year, okay, that was Japan. We've seen Hurricane Katrina and Rita. We've seen some horrendous, snowstorms on the East Coast, nor'easters. We have seen tornadoes, even in California, but the earthquakes have always been, okay, that's Los Angeles or it's San Francisco. It wasn't until 2004, and probably the early part of last decade, when we began to experience rolling blackouts more frequently, that it really struck me. I said, you know something, we got to be prepared for these kind of things. And then, of course, we had a big fire here in the city in 2004. And then in 2007, John, we had, the backup plan. We went through Plan B. That wasn't available. So we went to Plan C, and thank goodness Plan C worked. It was in a remote location. We have a place on the beach that's set up as an office as well. It's got the internet, it has computers, it has the same kind of phone system, has all the things that we could do to function as a business. But that was like, almost a 3 or 4 day period that we were running from a remote location. And now we even have our file servers that are backed up. They go to the data to an offsite location that's outside the city of San Diego. So all these important functions, and here's another thing that really, I was thinking about something that Kevin just said, and I'd like to share this with a lot of our listeners. I like to go sailing, and I have a little sail bag that I keep in my trunk at all times. I always keep a six-pack of water that I have in my trunk. I have a box of Clif Bars that I always have in there. I have Swiss Army knives, a Leatherman, all kinds of tools because, you go sailing, sometimes things break on the boat. So I have like a portable toolkit, water, all kinds of emergency repair stuff that I can have so that I'm prepared. But it came in handy in 2007 because I was the last person to leave our house here with the San Diego fires. And John, I was stuck in traffic for 3 hours because, you had 500,000 people where they were trying to evacuate out of the city. Thank goodness I had my power bars. I had my Clif Bars with me. So at least I had something in the car with me. But, these are the kind of things that, as Kevin talked about, we talked about planning for incapacity. It's very important if you're a senior or you're an individual that has to take very life-threatening medication that is very important to maintaining your health, that you have a three-month supply. Because what if something disrupted, a terrorist attack, power systems go down, oil refinery blows up or is taken out, and all of a sudden fuel becomes a shortage, as we saw with the hurricanes in 2005, where there were actually gasoline shortages in the East Coast and along the Gulf. So having prescription medications, infant formula, pet food, Kevin mentioned documents. How about cash and traveler's checks? What if, like here in San Diego, what if the power systems went down in your city? And John, when was it? Was it 2004 or 5? Remember it was on the East Coast where it was like 7 or 8 states that lost their power for, well, like 3 or 4 days. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that was caused by a failure of one substation that just caused a series of cascading failures.
Yeah, and that's what happened to San Diego last September when there was a power station on the Arizona border that went out, and the lights went out in San Diego. And the nice thing about being prepared, having an emergency supply kit, is that when a disaster or something emergency happens, you don't have to think, just as you mentioned, John. The San Diego fires, we have a box. We know exactly where our key documents were. We don't have to go looking for it. We have a checklist. We have medical supplies. I keep a medical supply kit in my car in addition to water and food. So there are a number of things, and I want to give out, as Kevin just did, is that there is a website that you can go to, which is called Ready, READY.gov. That's the FEMA website, and they have a fact sheet called What to Have, Recommended Items to Include in a Basic Emergency Supply Kit. Simple things like 1 gallon of water per day for at least 3 days, food at least for 3 days, a battery-powered or hand-cranked radio, and a NOAA weather radio. That came in handy, I know, for us last year when we lost power in the city for 8 hours because it was originally reported that it was a terrorist attack, and we have a hand-crank radio. And it was from that radio report that I learned what actually did happen. It was something that went out on a power station on the Arizona border, and they were giving estimates on how long they thought the power was out. Flashlight, first aid kit, a whistle to signal for anybody. And I can tell you, during the San Diego fires, I could barely see out my front driveway. There was so much smoke in the air. A dust mask to help filter contaminated air and plastic. We had those, and I used them in 2007 because there was no way. I mean, you could even breathe it inside the house. Garbage bags, toilets, wrench, pliers to turn off utilities, a can opener for food, local maps. All of this is listed at the website, which is Ready. That's www.ready.gov. And these supply kits that make up a supply kit are also at the FEMA website. And also, I want to mention the Red Cross website, which is redcross.org. And this is important depending on the kind of disasters and area that you live in. First of all, they have how to put together a kit, how to make a plan, how to keep yourself informed, how do you prepare, and then they have specific disaster preparedness kits for different kind of disasters. There's a whole page if you're living in an area that's prone to earthquake. Look, we just had an earthquake this week in Maine. Hurricane safety checklist, tornado safety checklist. They have a winter storm safety checklist, and even power outage safety checklist. So I don't want to go over all of these, but John, we're more likely to see all those, and not to mention the fact of a terrorist attack. I mean, we had one of our consulates attacked by a branch of Al-Qaeda in Libya. This week, they arrested a guy that was planning to bomb the Federal Reserve building in New York. Imagine the chaos that would cause in the financial system and the disruption. These are the kind of things that I don't care where you live. In the middle of the country, you could get hit by a terrorist attack. You could get hit by a winter storm. You could get hit by a tornado. This week, earthquake in Maine. So it doesn't matter where you live around the planet, around this country, it would behoove yourself. It doesn't take a lot of money to put something like this together and really protect yourself, because I'll tell you, it's going to bring a tremendous peace of mind when something happens. You already have plan B and plan C. You don't have to think. You know what to do. You're prepared for it. You have your food. You have your important documents. All those things are done in advance. You don't have to think instead of scrambling around the house. Because, John, you know what happens when a disaster hits. Good luck trying to find fresh water in a grocery store, batteries, flashlights, or the kind of emergency supplies that people need when something like this happens.
Yeah, the other thing that you might consider having is, I just got it for a birthday present, one of these, well, I got to put it over by the window, weather radio with all the different channels, and it runs off of either solar power or hand crank on the back. So you can just pull it out and doesn't require batteries. You just give it a crank. In an emergency, you've got something.
And something, John, that I've been really thinking about lately, and I've been working with local area ministers about this, because whether it's Katrina and Rita, which lasted for an extended period of time, or even that power outage that was almost a week, having a little bit more in the way of food supplies. And I just want to put in a plug here for Costco, because they have a sale that's going on right now. You can get freeze-dried food. You can get enough for 1 month. You can get enough for 3 months. You can get enough for a whole year. They even have emergency supplies where you can even have a kit. If you had to get out of town, let's say for 2 weeks, they have a supply kit that you can buy that will take care of two people for an extended period of time, for like 2 weeks. And so if you just go to Costco and type in freeze dried food, just spend a few moments on that site and take a look at the various food packages. I mean, you literally, our goal and what we're trying to get is a year's worth of food supply, and also an emergency kit that we're going to keep in the trunk that I'll add to the other things that I do. So anyway, hope you will find this helpful. And once again, the key websites that you can go to is ready, just like beingready.gov, FEMA.gov, and redcross.org.
You know, Jim, as you're watching world events, both from a geopolitical and a geoeconomic position, everything is rumbling along, but you can't help but get the impression we're rumbling towards a series of real hard bumps, which I guess is going to make the next 6 months, 6 to 12 months, really interesting, which hopefully we will be covering here on Financial Sense.
Well, you're right on that one, John. I mean, we've got the election coming up here. We're only, 19 days away from that. So somehow that's one issue that's going to be resolved. But right after that, we've got the fiscal cliff, in which case Congress comes back on November 14th and has 30 days to fix a monumental problem that they've been kicking the can down the road here for the last 3 years. So we got that ahead of us. And then, of course, we've got the fourth quarter season. And as we talked about with the LEIs, right now the LEIs are telling us the fourth quarter should be good. It should be a pickup from what we've seen in the third quarter. But then we have all kinds of other stuff that we'll have to think about. But, you know, we've been climbing a wall of worry all year long, but the stock market is still up double digits. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.
This segment of the Financial Sense NewsHour is brought to you by Nationwide Financial. For more information about Nationwide's products and services, please visit nationwide.com. That's nationwide.com. Neither Nationwide nor any of its affiliates is related to or affiliated with Jim Poplava of Poplava Securities, Incorporated.